Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. I am fully OIG operational today. Look, I've got my OIG mug, old school badge. I've got the OIG new school badge. Apparently, I'm fielding questions, comments, concerns, and complaints to the HHS tips line this week. I'm on shift. I got Matt and Wade. Matt Kachansky, retired special agent in charge from the OIG, the retired Northeast UPIC director, and our current payment integrity director, and Wade McFall, the retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office and a manager on our SIU investigative team. We were just, before we started recording, we were all sharing our respective OIG chum that we've collected over the years, shirts, badges, things of that sort. So it's a little nostalgia. We're being nostalgic today. So today we got, for our topic today, we want to talk about appeals, and we talk about appeals in the Medicare space, and it's probably very similar in the commercial space, although appeals rules may be different by payer and by contract and things of that sort. But since there tend to be a lot of things in the Medicare space, we'll use that as kind of our basis for our discussion today. And we're going to really put a focus on how a lot of that works and the appeal space works. It crosses over in the commercial space. And we want to talk a little bit about some ways to, you can never bulletproof your investigations, but you can certainly look to try to negate some of the things that are in that space. The first and foremost thing is that when making a request for records, in the Medicare space, they call it an ADR, additional document request. That would come from the UPIC, Unified Program Integrity Contractors, the MAC, Medicare Administrative Contractors, places of that sort. But you know, anytime that there's going to be a request for records, even if it comes from the investigative side, from an SIU, you're requesting those records. And one of the important pieces is to make sure that the request that you are making is squarely going to prompt the provider to produce all of the records relevant to that item, service, or procedure. And the big example I will always give is when a provider performs an ancillary service, like an ultrasound in the office, and the provider submits the ultrasound record, but doesn't provide any of the additional supporting documentation to explain why that ultrasound was medically necessary and why there was a need for it. And so it's important to be able to articulate that. And so Wade, I want to start with you, because shaping those requests and then providing the attestation are two of probably the most key pieces in an SIU's operational cadence to be able to ensure that when they are making that final determination about whether that claim should be paid or not, you're not stopping a provider from appealing. Providers have the ability to appeal, and oftentimes they're appealing with nothing new to provide. They just want to appeal and have their voice heard. But shaping those requests and making sure that the investigator's request letter is complete and accurate. You can do an audit or a review and it could be complete, but it could be inaccurate because you don't have all of the information. Or conversely, it could be accurate, but not complete because you don't have all the documents. So talk a little bit about the importance of being able to connect the people to shape those requests. And then let's really talk about the attestation, which is something that I think a lot of plans, you know, we've at least learned in some of our process improvement, a lot of plans are not doing these attestations, the importance of attestations and the relevance of it going forward.
Right. So I think the first step for the investigator that's generating the medical record request is to, depending on what the allegations are, what the provider's specialty is, what the claims in question are, is to have a good understanding of what documentation will be required to be able to support that. So if you don't know everything that's going to be required, there should be a conversation with the CPC who's going to be doing the review, doing the audit. Excuse me. So they should be able to tell you specific documents, whether it's nursing notes, whether it's, you know, there's 100 different, probably 1,000 different things that you could be requesting. But if you're not sure, speak with the CPC so they can tell you what you need up front. And then in the letter, you name as many of those documents by name that you can, so there's not any ambiguity. And then you you also want to add like the type of statement that's like, to include but not limited to, where you're going to say or any other documents that would tend to support the payment of this claim. So that pretty much covers you if you list everything you can think of that you're going to want, and then you kind of throw that caveat in there that anything else that you think might be important, include those as well. And then the other portion at the end of the medical record request, after you list the sample of patients that you are requesting records for, that would include their name, their date of birth, and date of service, you want to put the attestation at the end where whoever's providing the records is going to attest to, and the wording might be different on some of the different attestations we use with different clients, but it essentially is going to say, I, you know, state your name, certify or attest that the records that I am supplying or providing is a complete set, and basically, like, I don't have other records. So that's kind of their statement to that. But in many cases, once we do the review and we send the results to them, almost without fail, they're going to say, oh, well, I have other, you know, if it's saying there's insufficient documentation, all of a sudden they have other records that they didn't provide, even though we, I think, thoroughly asked for the correct set of records. But almost without fail, they're going to come back and say, oh, I have more. So then when they provide more, we have to make a determination. Did they just not understand this would help to support the claim, or did, in some cases, did they fabricate new documentation after the fact, which is a problem. If we look at it and we think they just didn't provide it the first time around, we'll provide that to the CPC and let them take another go at it. And many times that second set of documentation they send in, even though it's past what they attested to, that may be enough to support the claim. And if that's the case, we're going to, you know, it's going to come off the overpaid claims kind of list. But the attestation is important, so we can at least limit that amount of times that they're going to come back and just keep saying, oh, I have this. And, you know, three or four times they're adding more documents. So we'll give them a one chance after the attestation if they have something that legitimately supports the claims. But after that, it's kind of like, okay, you've had two chances, and we might stick with the overpayment rationale at that point.
You know, one thing that I always find pretty interesting is the fact that oftentimes when we look at a lot of the work that we do in this space with our SIU clients, and really when we're looking at policies and procedures and we're doing those SIU kind of quality improvement and scorecards, is how many plans we look at that don't have a policy on the process for requesting medical records, you know, whether it be through probe sampling, statistical sampling. And I think we've probably beat the methodology horse dead multiple times through the podcasts here, blogs, LinkedIn Lives. We just constantly are beating into the conversation, the sampling methodology. And this goes right into that. It's like, you know, your policies and procedures have to reflect the manner and the means and the methods in which you're going to be employing for the purposes of getting those records, but also what is your language going to be for those attestations for consistency. I've seen some plans, and I think this is a great idea, where when they give that letter to the, when they send that letter to the provider with the list of records and the attestation, they also have a little bit of a place for a provider to provide a checklist, you know, patient, you know, Mary Smith, date of service, provided with a check mark, or a place for the provider to initial. The other thing that I think is pretty interesting is, you know, in a lot of instances, some of the things that trigger denials, like failure to provide legible notes if the provider's not using an EMR, or failure to provide a signed medical record, right? Two requirements that are technical violations. I have seen some plans in their letter to the provider will put language in that says, if these records are illegible or if there is no signature, please do the following. So you're kind of giving them the impetus, like, don't have a technical violation for something that you don't need a technical violation for. So, you know, these are things that an SIU can do to help increase its efficiency, right? Which generates more ROI. And I think it's one of those intangible pieces where if you do things on the front end, you're going to save yourself a lot of grief on the back end on those appeals. And the last thing, Wade, that I want to talk about is when you do finish your investigation, or we'll call it your review, and you do send that overpayment letter, is the importance of attaching to that letter the findings from the investigative group, you know, the auditor that did it, the investigator, on what those denials are. Now, in some states, there is a regulatory requirement to submit to the provider the reasons, the rationale for those denials. While it's not necessarily going to stop a provider from appealing, it certainly can cut down on the amount of communication leading up to that appeal, right?
Yeah, and I think in most cases, we will send at least, well, as at a minimum, the summary of the audit. And it's going to say X amount of records were reviewed, X amount were approved, and X amount were denied, and then the dollar amount. And then there's a spreadsheet that goes along with that that will show line by line the whether or not the claim was approved or denied. It'll have the denial rationale. It'll have links to the regulations that support that. Now, in some cases, we maybe won't send that with the original overpayment letter, just because sometimes we only have a fax number and we'll fax the overpayment letter. If we don't have a direct email to somebody, we fax the overpayment letter, but the overpayment letter says in it that upon request, we'll provide this spreadsheet that has a line by line rationale for the approval and denial. And in that case, we almost always within a day or so will get response. It's got, you know, the investigator's email. We'll get a response saying, yeah, I need to see the denial rationale. Now we have a legit email address that we can deal with somebody with. Right. And then they can look at it. And for each claim that's denied, they can sort by approved or denied. They can look at each denied claim, see what the denial rationale is, and then see the, you know, a link to the regulation that the CPC is following. So that should give them a thorough understanding of why things were denied. And in some cases, they might come back and they might give additional information that we will look at and the CPC will look at. And if it's for whatever reason, the CPC says that's reasonable, or maybe instead of just flat out denying the claim, if there was a claim that was, or a procedure code that was similar, that you know, instead of denying a $100 claim, maybe we'll say, oh, if you use this other code, we would have paid $80. So instead of $100 overpayment, right, we're looking at $20 overpayment. But that spreadsheet really gives, it's a key to the audit, and it really gives them, it should answer all the questions as to why these claims are denied.
Yeah, and that's going to be, you look at that spreadsheet, you're looking, you know, at, was this claim allowed? You know, sometimes you're talking about supported, unsupported, right? But it's basically, if you're talking about supported or unsupported, ultimately what you're doing is you're saying this claim was allowed, changed, or denied. Allowed, we agree with it. Denied, it shouldn't have been paid under any circumstances. And changed is kind of your example. There is a different code and you're entitled to the delta, or you owe us the delta on that. But, you know, I think a key part of this is that SIUs really should have within their policies and procedures references to any applicable state or federal guidelines that require the disclosure of that audit sheet. And, you know, you brought up a really good investigative technique, which is, hey, we're not 100% sure how to communicate all of this to the provider. So maybe you start, you know, maybe you've sent an email and it gets kicked back. Maybe you send an email and it's not been responded to. Maybe, you know, whatever the reason is, you go and you do one piece of the puzzle, which is just send the letter, which is what you're doing. What we're really talking about is, how do you set an environment to create a dialogue and an exchange for communication with that provider on either negotiating that settlement or, you know, whatever it's going to be, in an instance where you don't have necessarily all of the demographic information or contact information that you need for that provider. So it's actually a great tip, because it's, you know, we're starting the ball rolling, and it's almost like you send the letter and say, should you wish to get additional information, please email, you know, investigator Wade McFall at whatever the number is. And if Wade McFall is not available, then you can email Wade McFowl, because I think they're very similar people. So you can kind of figure that out. So,
spelled the same,
all right. Too. So now we've gone through a lot of that, the appeals, what have you. So Matt, let's talk about, you know, from the appeals perspective. And I think, you know, where the appeals piece of the puzzle becomes muddy in the Medicare space is the fact, and I think a lot of people don't really even understand this, is the number of appeals levels that exist in Medicare, there's like five or six, right? So let's talk about what the different levels of appeals are. What are the time periods for those appeals? And where does that all go?
Okay, sure. Yeah, and I'm doing this from the YPIC perspective. So, we're the ones that calculate the overpayment. We do not collect the overpayment. We send all of our enforcement actions through the MAC, the Medicare Administrative Contractor, who then would send the overpayment letter to the provider and give them the chance to appeal. And there are multiple levels of appeal, starting with the redetermination, which is the provider going to the MAC itself saying the UPIC was wrong, please re-review. And they have to do that within 120 days of the MAC sending them the overpayment letter. And the UPIC at that point is asked to submit everything to the MAC that supports their overpayment, and that's it. That's the last time the UPIC is involved in this appeal process, except perhaps at the ALJ, where they can be a presenter but not really a witness. So the MAC does their re-review, and let's say they uphold, the denials. The next step is through the QIT, the quality improvement contractor,
Right, the
which is the second level of appeal.
QIC,
QIC, the
QIC.
QIC, which is a reconsideration. So you had a redetermination, now a reconsideration. They have 180 days between the MAC decision on the redetermination to file an appeal at the QIC level. So now you're looking at, 9 months since the initial overpayment when it's reached the second level of appeal at the QIC. And the QIC is, that's all they do is they do these reconsiderations of the redeterminations. And again, the provider throughout this can be submitting additional information to each of these levels. The government through the UPIC, through the MAC, through the QIC have to rely on the original information upon which the overpayment was based. So it
So
gets
Matt,
through
does
the
that
QIC.
mean just to clarify that? So basically, what that really means is that the documents that the UPIC relied upon in making its decision, and each subsequent appeal, those original documents remain static.
Yes.
That at each level, the documents that the UPIC used in its reliance upon its determinations, as the appeals process goes forward, the original documents the provider submitted do not change, but the documents that the provider can produce can change. So there's a very heavy deference in the appeals process to the provider. And I think this is an important point that a lot of people in our space don't always understand, that regardless of the fact, the problem I've always had is that oftentimes on the provider community, providers often feel that these appeals are nothing more than rubber stamping of the prior level's determinations. And I can unequivocally tell you that that doesn't happen because on appeals, you oftentimes see error rates start to decline. And we could have another conversation about high sustained error rates and prepay, but you often will see that as the appeals process progresses, the error rate declines along the way. And so it's an important piece to understand that it's a little bit of an odd situation because the government, meaning the UPIC, the CMS side of this, those documents are locked in stone. They don't change. Providers have the ability to be dynamic. And so I want to just make that clear. And then also, Matt, the piece of the puzzle also is that when we get to the ALJ, is talk about the ability to produce live testimony and things of that sort.
Correct. Yeah, the last normal level of appeal then is an ALJ hearing, an administrative law judge hearing, which has to be requested within 60 days of the QIC's redetermination decisions. And for that, it is the ALJ will have a hearing with live testimony. And I would say 90% of the time, there's no one from the government at those hearings. They are still, again, relying on the documentation that was submitted. At the UPIC, we would sometimes have a statistician appear if the question was about the methodology for an SVRS and things like that. We would have them testify or at least ask question or answer questions that are raised. Usually they are not allowed in as official witnesses, but they can be there if the judge has a question. And with that, you know, the defense can bring in the beneficiaries or the members. They can bring in their own experts. They can bring in policy people. They can, you know, have the provider or the billing clerk or whoever they want testify in support of the claims. And again, the government largely relies on the original submission of the overpayment from the UPIC to the MAC and the supporting documentation that was originally submitted now, you know, 10 months prior. After that, a lot of the part, if it's a Part A issue, the hospital or nursing home, it can go to the Medicare Advisory Council, which is sort of like a Jedi Council. They're subject matter experts in Part A, cost reporting, things of that nature. And they can, if there's issues that are unresolved, they try to resolve them. And I've been involved in a few of those, and it is technical and complex, and you really have to know your stuff to be involved in that process. The last one is district court for any appeals, where, you know, administratively you've felt that you haven't been, your issues have not been resolved. You can take it to federal district court. The deadlines for that, I believe, are statutorily applied. It might even be as long as 6 years, but the minimum claim balance has to be $1,760 for it to reach the level of a district court. And that's where an AUSA is going to be fighting for the government. And at that point, I do believe they have the government can testify, but again, it's still on the original right. information that was provided.
And by the way, $1,760 is a pretty de minimis amount. And so the question then becomes, are you spending more money by having a lawyer file your civil action against the government than the juice worth the squeeze, right?
That's right. And to bring this back full circle, you know, Wade talked about the importance of the medical record request being, you know, thorough and the attestation being in place and this goes, you know, and now you see it go through these appeals where, you know, you mentioned, Eric, the denial rates are starting to go down, right? And that's natural. You know, some of these things are going to fall off because the provider has provided additional documentation. What the UPICs try to do and what SIU should try to do is, you know, follow that. You know, what was the additional documentation? You know, did we ask for it initially or not? If not, let's learn from that and ask for it the next time and make this a process improvement circle where the results of the appeals will then impact how you put the next medical record review in place.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And that is part and parcel to the importance of the intrinsic connection that payment integrity has to have, that there has to be a greater level of seamlessness between the fraud group, which is the SIU, and the waste abuse group, which is typically your payment integrity, your policy group, that there has to be that. Because at the end of the day, you know, as a great example, we know we talked about the ultrasounds, but for example, in behavioral health, there's instances where a provider may be asked to provide particular dates of service for treatment regimens for therapy. And the provider provides those because that's what they were asked to provide pursuant to that letter, that ADR, or that request letter. But at the end of the day, in the behavioral health space, as a great example, because we're seeing a lot of these fraud cases in BH, there are instances where the individual treatment regimen ties back to a plan of care or a treatment plan or something like that. If you don't have that treatment plan or that plan of care, you're going to wind up denying services that might actually be approved, but you don't know, right? So what you've done is you've done a complete audit but it's not accurate because you're missing information. Or alternatively, you may look at a particular claim and it may be an accurately audited claim, but it's not complete because you're missing a piece of the dates of service. So, right, that intrinsic connection has to exist. You cannot silo your auditors from your investigators for things that involve cases that are outside of the normal. You know, if we're looking at an evaluation and management case or a PT case, that may be a little bit different. You start getting into these subspecialties, these nuances, the ancillary services. You know, another one that comes to mind is ophthalmology. A provider bills for cataract surgery, for example. What are the documents that the provider should have in their records that show the things leading up to the cataract surgery? Things like the E&M that shows that the patient has a cataract and where it is, that it's not just 1% or 2%, that it's, you know, obstructing vision. Where's your refraction? Where are what they call the A scans and the B scans, which are the way to measure what they call the ocular in the internal ocular implants on those things. So, you know, those pieces of the puzzle are really important that an investigator may not know. If you've not investigated an ophthalmology case, if you've not investigated a behavioral health case, and you don't know these things, you have to go, right? It's not about knowing everything, it's knowing who to go to get these answers, right? So those become those intrinsic pieces of the puzzle that put, Wade, your situation, right, on completeness and accuracy and the attestations together with Matt's piece, which is, how do you as the SIU seek to reduce the number of appeals that come into the SIU? Appeals have a negative impact on ROI because you're arguing time that is being spent by a team of people to argue on an appeal, reevaluating an audit, additional documents. If the provider was told specifically what needed to be provided, and I get it, the catch-all, Wade, including but not limited to, is great. How many providers actually on an appeal start to produce additional records? A fair amount. We see it pretty frequently. So the catch-all, including but not limited to, doesn't work. It just doesn't work. We put it in there because we want to be able to say, you've given us everything, but it really doesn't move the ball. It's language that needs to be in there, but it doesn't really move the ball. And I think, you know, when you're starting to talk about your ROI, which is in the SIU space of an important piece, tangible and intangible, is how do you start to reduce your in-house, your own in-house waste, right? Time waste. And one of the ways is by trying to reduce the incidence of appeal. I can tell you for one of the plans that we're doing audit work on, investigative work on, and appeals work on, we are working very closely with the overall payment integrity team to create a bit of a seamlessness between the groups because that doesn't exist right now. And what we're noticing is providers are appealing things that they should not be appealing because they don't have enough of the information. They haven't been provided the requisite documents. They haven't been told specifically what's needed for that review, and they're left with guesswork. And that's the problem. As investigators, we don't want to have there be an instance of, we don't want to work with guessing. We want to work with facts. So it's a very big piece of the puzzle. Appeals are an important part of that continuum. And, you know, we work really hard here to try to help to salvage the instances of appeals and reduce them. And while we're talking kind of specifically in the Medicare space, it doesn't necessarily change in the commercial space. It doesn't change necessarily in the Medicaid space. You know, and you have to be able to stand behind the work you do. You know, another great example is if you're going to pull statistical sampling, you've got to be able to support your premise for your statistical sampling. We're working right now with a payer where they don't have the ability to support their statistical sampling methodology. We're providing that PhD level statistician to do that. So it's that full circle. You've got to be able to produce all of those documents, recreate your methodology, support your findings, justify your findings with the supporting documentation and the like. So, you know, we're happy to have conversations with payers out there that may have a lack of policies and procedures and give you some of that language and help with providing some of the language for attestations and the like. Just let us know, and we're here to help. So, you know, we're out of time. This is one of those topics where we probably could talk for hours about the loopholes that exist, the workarounds, things of that sort, and how to tighten up those policies and procedures. So we'll continue this conversation. As always, great insight from both you guys from the investigative perspective, the government's perspective, all of that. It's great stuff. So as always, thank you guys for providing that insight. And thank you to everybody for participating in our weekly OIG roundtables. Again, you can get this OIG roundtable every Thursday. We put it out on LinkedIn. Just connect up with us on LinkedIn. It's in the newsletters every Friday, YouTube, Spotify. The content is always there. And we appreciate everybody joining us. And we look forward to seeing you all on the next OIG roundtable. Take care, everybody.
And if you need used OIG swag for a reasonable price, contact Eric Rubenstein.
Gently used on my OnlyFans page. We'll see you.